welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and a quick programming note. We had planned today to have Mayor Howard Klug from Williston be with us. However, our interview this morning went a little longer than planned. I want to bring you the entire interview. I think it's compelling, and we'll have him for you tomorrow right here on Main Street. Main Street begins today with the first in a series of shows dedicated to education in North Dakota with North Dakota's Teacher of the Year, Franny Tunseth. Today, we're looking at one of the most urgent issues in North Dakota education, recruiting, retaining, and respecting teachers. Every teaching field in the state is now officially a shortage area, and the strain is especially felt in rural districts and Native communities. Fewer young people are entering the profession, and many experienced teachers are stepping away, citing burnout, low pay, heavy workloads, and a sense that their work isn't valued. Teachers often wear multiple hats as instructors, counselors, and social-emotional supports, and those hats can get heavy. Many believe the path forward is clear: better salaries and benefits, stronger mentoring for new teachers, and a healthier school culture built on trust and cutting back on the paperwork that pulls teachers away from teaching. And to help us understand what's happening and what can change, we're joined by two people who know this landscape well. Franny Tunseth, she comes back to Main Street and she's collaborating with us and is North Dakota's 2026 Teacher of the Year. She teaches reading and math intervention for grades 4-8 at Mayport CG in Mayville. Over her 11 years in education, she's worked in classrooms from kindergarten through middle school, served as an elementary principal, and taught in both North Dakota and Minnesota. Franny believes that every child can experience success every day with the right support. Franny, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me, Craig. I've just been so excited about this conversation. I've actually been a little giddy about it.
We have been excited as well. We're also joined by a mentor of yours, Dr. Diane Palowitz. She's an associate professor of education at the University of North Dakota. She's a historian of education policy whose work examines how teacher pay, respect, and professional culture have shaped and sometimes strained the profession. She's the author of Blaming Teachers and the editor of Walkout, and she's founded UND's Initiative for Rural Education, Equity, and Economic Development. Together, they're going to help us understand today's challenges. Dr. Palowitz, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much. It's really a treat to be with you.
All right, let's set the stage here. North Dakota is facing a teacher shortage, especially in rural and high needs communities. Franny, you first, from your perspective, why does this issue matter right now?
Well, I think that's a really important question, Craig. And when I reflect on it, I think there's lots of reasons why it matters, but I really want to talk about two of them. I think that the North Dakota teacher shortage really matters right now because it's directly impacting our students, right? There's their access to consistent, high quality learning, especially in the rural and high needs communities where there is that little margin for turnover. I think that when positions go unfilled or they're changing frequently, students lose the stability. They lose the opportunity to have those authentic, long lasting relationships, and they lose opportunities, simply put. But at the same time, I think it increases the work for our teachers that we already have, right? You start to have teachers having to take on additional classes or responsibilities or support roles. And I think that added strain just really makes it harder for teachers to meet students' needs. And I think it further threatens retention. And it just creates this really, unique cycle that I think is very difficult for schools to break.
Dr. Palowitz, how about you? Why is it important to talk about this issue right now?
Yeah, well, Franny is absolutely right. And I think, you know, I'll talk about two big issues here. One, education generally, but public schools specifically, are critically important for communities. These are community hubs. They're not just for what they offer children during learning hours in the classrooms, which is important, I'll talk about in a second, but for what they offer for communities as a whole, especially in rural areas. These are hubs of resources and social connection, and incredibly important. And we've seen quite a bit as schools have been consolidated and communities lose their schools, what happens to those communities. So there's an important story here about the critical value of public education. But even more specifically about the teacher shortages, that we know that, you know, researchers have documented that of all the factors that can inform how students do in school, there are few, if any, that are measurably as important as teachers. And so if we don't have teachers in the classrooms who have been professionally educated and well supported, we're really setting the kids of a community, the kids of the state and nation at a real disadvantage.
You know, I considered recruitment of teachers when we hear in the news, teacher shortage. Okay, we got to recruit more teachers. It's like that. But Franny has really brought it to my vision that no, it's as much about retention and respect. Mm-hmm. Explain to me, Franny, you first, how these mm-hmm. three things are all connected.
Yeah, well, when I think about recruitment, Craig, we're obviously talking about bringing teachers into the profession, right? Retention is keeping our schools stable and making sure that we have and retain our really qualified teachers. But respect, to me, is really what sustains both of those things. And so teachers are more likely to stay when they feel supported, trusted as professionals, and able to do their work well. And so without that respect and the sustainable working conditions, I think recruitment efforts alone don't solve the shortage issue.
Dr. Palowitz, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, again, and maybe this is what I'm going to be saying again and again, but Franny's absolutely right. You know, I think that there are a variety of factors that inform whether a person chooses to come to the schools and then stay in the schools. And respect is a critical factor. So too is how we talk about public education generally. You know, the importance of schools, how well they're doing. And so these are sometimes less visible and they're harder to kind of measure, but really critical, as Franny's saying.
We're going to drill down on that topic of public education versus other education options in North Dakota and how it impacts this topic a little bit later in this discussion. But Dr. Palowitz, let me ask you first this time. You see students who are coming to the University of North Dakota. What do they tell you draws them into teaching in the first place? Because I'm sure there are many, many issues that incoming freshman has never thought about.
Yeah. I mean, so we always have the students who are called to teaching because they feel it deeply, right? Like they've known from the time they were young that they wanted to do this, that maybe they have a family member who is in teaching. Maybe they have had a wonderful experience. They've had a teacher like Franny and they want to kind of pay that forward. We'll hopefully always have that group of students who are really called to the work of teaching. I think where the challenge comes is broadening beyond those people who just knew from the time they were young that this is what they wanted to do, and to make teaching seem a really viable career pathway for all students. And that's, I think, our challenge right now.
Franny, you see teachers that have now been through 4 years of education coming into your building, coming into your community. What are they telling you drew them to education?
Well, I think Diana's so right. I think it's just going to be a ping pong ball of like, yes, and right. But I think it's because they want to make a difference, right? They want to build those meaningful relationships and they love students. They want to be able to make a difference and they want to be able to contribute to their communities, especially in rural areas. We have a lot of people that graduate from our schools, go to education, want to come back and contribute to our community. You know, I think that as educators, most of us don't enter the profession for external rewards. We know we're not going to get rich. But I think we enter because we know our work matters. Teachers remain committed when they feel supported, they're trusted as professionals, and we're able to meet students' needs without burning out. But I think that where we're talking about like what determines whether or not they stay, I think it's when strong intentions are met with overwhelming workloads, with limited support or a lack of respect. I think even the most passionate educators kind of begin to question like, gosh, can I really do this work and still be a person outside of my job? And really, can I continue this?
I want to dust off something real quick, and it's something that I hadn't thought about until just right now. Some people say, and I think it's a load of malarkey, that, hey, teachers get the summers off. Come on.
Oh, golly.
Come on, let's go. It's not that hard. Mm-hmm. Franny, tell us a little bit more about what makes teaching difficult today.
Well, first of all, Craig, I want to preface that by saying that teachers do not get their summers off, that we are paid a 185-day contract. And so we are paid for the work that we do. And I really just want to preface that, but also just talk about, golly, the amount of hours that educators put in that they aren't paid for, right? Like this is not an 8-to-4 job. It wouldn't be sustainable. We wouldn't be able to meet students' needs if it wasn't. But I think that like this job is very difficult. And I can, you know, only speak to my own context and the conversations I've had with other educators throughout my career. But I mean, every single day, we are met with severe behavior, students really battling severe mental health issues, trying to, you know, meet students' needs, but also teach to the standards that we need to teach and make sure that we are promoting citizens that can go out and be successful in our community. You know, it's no longer just this job where you come in and you teach the content. We are meeting students' emotional, social, behavioral needs every single day with limited and limited resources. Diana, can you speak to that a little bit more too?
Absolutely. I mean, I think another issue too is that, you know, you think about teachers' work as what they're doing in the classroom. Right? That takes a lot of preparation and planning. And that's not typically something that is well compensated or that we give teachers a lot of extra time for. And so when you start to think about all the extra hours that teachers are investing to create activities, to think about how to meet the individual needs of their students, this is no longer an 8-to-4 job. And I think, you know, there has been this intensification of education in the post-COVID years that has really had a real impact on how teachers experience their work lives.
What do you mean that intensification? What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So, you know, there's been some really good studies on this that, you know, during the COVID years, the immediate COVID years, there was this kind of all hands on deck approach, right? And it's an emergency situation. So we're all going to dive in into this. As COVID waned or became more under control, however we want to think about it, the additional work tasks that fell on teachers' laps during those years didn't necessarily come off again. And so teachers are still in this work environment where these additional demands, whether it's like Franny is talking about, these additional social emotional needs or remote instruction when students aren't in class, this idea that doesn't matter, we can still provide it this way, and teachers are kind of teaching multiple modalities at a given time, that hasn't really come off teachers' plates. But at the same time, they haven't gotten additional monetary support or other sort of resources to create space for all those tasks.
So if we reduce everything down, Diana, you first here, what do you think is pushing teachers out more and more today than perhaps 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think there's a few different things here. So I think that work intensification is a key issue. I think that, you know, so teacher shortages are not new to this era, right? They are a historical phenomenon and a pretty predictable one at that, right? When we have times that there are other opportunities for teachers outside of the schools, then we see these shortages, right? Now, when the economy shifts and we have fewer of those opportunities, teaching becomes really desirable work. And so we see the opposite happen. And so there's a little bit of that predictable ebb and flow that happens. But I would say some of the things that make this different than other shortages that we've seen, in addition to the work intensification, is right now there really is a proliferation of other work opportunities for young people and for seasoned teachers, right? People who have been in the classroom for a decade. You know, a few generations ago, teaching was the only option, one of the only options for college-educated women. That's certainly not the scenario right now. But with remote work and other opportunities, there are a lot of different options that people are considering. And I think you add to that sort of shifting generational ideas about work-life balance, about, you know, I think this idea, you know, of a generation or two ago that I'm going to stay with an employer for my whole career. And I'm going to retire at this place. And so things that would have been a big incentive to folks of that mindset of like my retirement benefits would have mattered a lot to me then. But if I'm not thinking about my retirement benefits or staying at this one place, but I'm thinking about paying off my student loans and getting my first home and just starting a life, but then maybe I'm going to move around a little bit. I have different sort of, I'm looking maybe for different things than I would have been otherwise.
Franny, have you had a colleague come up to you and say, Franny, can't do it anymore. Just can't do it anymore.
Craig, I think the amount of colleagues I've had come up and say that is very concerning. You know, there's a new study that was just completed by like the Center of, golly, I have it written down here, but they were just talking the other day about how golly, I want to make sure I find this for you, but they were saying that up to 70% of educators have either A, left the profession or are actively looking to get out of the profession. And that to me is an extremely large number. And it's a very concerning number. And so, yes, like even in my rural space, like I've had numerous educators come up and just be like, golly, I don't know how much longer I can do this job.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to North Dakota Teacher of the Year, Franny Tunseth, and UND Education Professor, Dr. Diana Pelowitz, about teacher retention, recruitment and respect, and what it will take to strengthen North Dakota's educator workforce. Let's talk about practice and policy connection. How do classroom conditions, class size, instructional support, time for planning, all of these things affect a little bit about student success, but more about teacher sustainability?
Sure, happy to hop in. You know, so of all the factors that can push a teacher out of the classroom, one of the ones that seems to be documented high in that list is teacher burnout. And so, you know, that those things that you just listed, class size, the level of instructional support, time for planning, all of those things directly feed into whether a teacher feels like they're burning out or they have that sort of space to do their professional work. You know, large class sizes are hard to manage. When you have a new teacher coming into the schools who, you know, an increasing problem right now that schools are facing is teachers who are coming in because of the shortage who don't have the same level of professional education as teachers 5 years ago. And so they're needing a lot more support than your typical first
year. Why is that? Why don't they have the same level of professional education?
Well, this has been one way that states around the nation have been trying to deal with the teacher shortage, right? Mm. So we need people in buildings. And one of the ways that we've done that is by opening the pathway into the classrooms, right? So we're loosening requirements, we're creating emergency pathways in because it's a significant problem to not have an adult in a classroom. But many schools right now are facing a related but different problem, which is the prevalence of underprepared teachers, which is putting more pressure on those mentor teachers, those teachers who are in their 5 years plus, on administrators at a time when there really are not that level of resources in the schools. So it's a complex problem all around.
Franny, you talk often about mentoring and supports. When teachers have the right supports in place, first of all, what are those supports in your eyes? And secondly, how does it change their energy, their confidence, and their willingness to stay in the vocation?
Oh, gosh, I love that question, Craig. You know, when I think about those supports, I think it's about removing the barriers that prevent teachers from doing their job, whether it is protecting the planning time. Just a simple check-in sometimes can make or break your day, right? Having an administrator come in and just say like, hey, how's the day going? Is there anything that you need, anything that I can do for you? But simply put, I think that when those supports are in place, it really changes everything. I think that educators have more energy because they're not constantly in the survival mode. I think they're more confident because they feel equipped to like really handle and meet student needs. And I really think too, there's that stronger sense of purpose because they're able to fulfill and complete their work. And so when we have mentorship and supports in place, it really allows teachers to focus on teaching rather than managing those barriers, which increases the job satisfaction. And I think it makes staying in the profession feel possible, but also worthwhile. It really moves from like survival to thrival. You know, if you want to put it really simply, it really is. We can just help teachers feel like they're making a difference and like they're able to sustain this work long term.
Dr. Palois, that sounds simple to me, right? That should be in place in everybody's vocation, teacher or not, yet perhaps it isn't. In education in North Dakota?
It is not even a North Dakota phenomenon. I think that teaching is complex work. These are problems that we see across the board. I think the biggest misnomer about teaching is that it's easy. And I think that changing that, right, and really sort of as communities, as a nation, embracing this idea of why are professionally educated teachers important, and what is a professional educator? What are we looking to them for, right? We don't raise those questions about, you know, our dentist or a doctor or a lawyer, but there is this real myth that teaching is somehow easy work. And I think that is a real detriment.
What happens to retention when teachers, Franny, just feel they can't meet the students' needs if they think that they're not doing the job?
Well, gosh, you know, Craig, I've been in that situation, right? I've been in situations where I have students in my classroom and it's like, golly, like, I just feel like like I'm not making a difference. Like, I can't help the student learn, whether it's the barriers or like, you know, academic delays or whatever it is. And it really weighs on you deeply day after day. And you're trying to constantly like reinvent and figure out like, how can you make these changes and how can you help students learn? And there's almost a sense of helplessness that comes with that. And they can really slowly drive away you from the profession that you love. And I think that is one reason why educators absolutely step out, because they feel like they aren't good enough or like they can't meet the students' needs.
And when that happens, Dr. Palois, what should happen for a teacher who's feeling just emotionally stressed that, hey, I can't cut it, but they're teaching today? What should happen?
Yeah, I mean, what Franny has just described are kind of the core contours of teacher burnout. right? And so this is where, I mean, we first of all want to prevent teachers from getting into that circumstance of feeling like they are trying their hardest, they are doing all the things and not able to be successful. So mentoring is a big part of that, having supports and resources for teachers, but increasing other staff within the schools, right? This is, I know we're talking a lot about teacher recruitment and retention, but this is also, you know, administrators in the building and school counselors and health providers and other folks who can provide support to teachers while they're giving that kind of key instruction that needs to happen.
I want to shift gears just a little bit and talk about something I referenced in the beginning of our conversation, and that is the pressures of rural school districts. So give us some insight into the biggest challenges between rural or other high need schools face mm-hmm. when they're trying to recruit teachers. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm a student here in NDSU mm-hmm. or wherever, and I've got 46 restaurants that I can go to dinner to tonight, or, you know, this Friday night or whatever. But I also have this option of maybe moving to very rural North Dakota mm-hmm. where I have zero options for any restaurants to come. So that's just one little thing that enters my mind mm-hmm. into the challenges of rural teachers and recruiting. Franny, what do you think the yeah. biggest challenges are?
Well, I think there's several. You know, I think that when we're looking at rural schools, I think that you can look at it with a very asset-based lens and talk about all the great things that there are in rural schools. And there are lots of them. And I want to preface it by saying that. But there are difficulties. And I think it's important to have that conversation, that dialogue, and be thought partners about how can we try to combat some of those things when you're talking to teachers that want to go in and be educators, or we're going in and talking to UND, NDSU teachers to say, come to our schools, right? But oftentimes when we look at rural schools, there are often fewer resources, right? There's sometimes heavier workloads and a sense of isolation. There are schools where you can go and you are the only third grade teacher in the entire district, or you're the only history teacher. And, like, you know, collaboration is non-existent unless you're trying to collaborate with teachers outside of your space. And so I think those things can make it harder for teachers to feel supported when you have limited budgets and funding and you're trying to do more with less. Sometimes that means as a teacher, you're buying things out of your own pocket. And we've had that conversation about that's not always feasible either for educators. But like you said, Craig, like, you have the things that are inside a school, but you also have the things that are outside of the school. You have limited housing options. You have the lower pay compared to urban areas. And two, a thing that I think we don't always talk about is that the fewer professional development opportunities that can happen in rural schools as we're trying to recruit and retain teachers as well. So I think it's not about teachers not wanting to necessarily work in these spaces. It's about the system making it really hard for them to say yes and stay. And I think that part of this is having these conversations like we're having today to talk about, like, how can we rework these and help make it incentivized or a little more attractive for new teachers.
Dr. Palowitz, what do you see as the biggest challenges for rural or high need schools yeah. as they try to recruit teachers?
Yeah, I mean, these challenges of recruitment are largely universal, but there are some really specific ones to rural and more remote areas. And I think Franny's talking about that with the, you know, there are a whole load of opportunities for professional growth and for community and sense of belonging that are real resources here. But on the flip side, right, there are challenges. You think about a math teacher who might be wanting to go to a larger school and teach, you know, four sections of Algebra 1 versus, mm-hmm. you know, in a rural school, there might be a math teacher who's going to teach, you know, stats, calc, algebra, geometry, right? That's just a different type of work experience. Now, an exciting one too. But I think that Franny hit on something that's really important, that, you know, it would be a mistake to think about all of this as something that's within the school building. I think there are factors beyond the schools that play huge importance here. Housing is one of them. When I've spoken with school leaders and superintendents across North Dakota, one of the things that they have spoken about is the critical importance of affordable housing. At, you know, that the cost of building new properties is substantial, that there are not always homes available. So, you know, if you have somebody who grew up in this area, then maybe you can recruit them back. But if you're trying to recruit a broader population of people who are excited to teach in a rural school, but you don't have any place for them to live, that's a really significant issue. That combined with financial issues, like students anywhere are also thinking about paying off their own student debt and paying their bills. And so it's that kind of perfect storm.
We're going to take a quick break here and have news here of North Dakota and the region. But after that, we'll resume our conversation with North Dakota Teacher of the Year, Franny Tunseth, and UND Education Professor, Dr. Diane Palowitz. Stay with us. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're resuming now our conversation about teacher recruitment, retention, and respect, and what it will take to strengthen North Dakota's educator workforce. My guests are Dr. Diana Palowitz. She's from the University of North Dakota, where she's an education professor, and also North Dakota Teacher of the Year, Franny Tunseth. She teaches in Mayville. All right, we've talked a little bit about the tough stuff for rural teachers, and you've alluded to a little bit, Franny, that there's also a lot of good stuff. Can you tell me more? Can you tell me more about
that? I would love to. You know, Craig, and I know we've had this conversation off the podcast or, you know, the radio as well, but I just think that rural teaching comes with so many unique strengths, and I'm very passionate about it, and I love it so much. Small communities mean you can build really deep, lasting relationships with students and with families, and I think, too, teachers wear multiple hats, which can be really meaningful work. You know, I love being able to roll up my sleeves and help support students in any way that they need. And so I absolutely love teaching in a small school. I think one of my favorite things too is just the sense of like community that you have in a small school. I know Diana had mentioned it earlier, but schools really are the heartbeat of a community. It's where so many incredible things happen, whether it's the basketball games and everyone comes to cheer each other on, or, you know, I've shared stories, Craig, with you of like last year, my three-year-old daughter, invited a bunch of 16-year-olds to her birthday party and they all came, you know, I mean, it is like heartwarming. You saw these great big kids coming to her birthday party and just celebrating her. And that, I don't think that happens in urban schools as much. I think that's the magic of a rural school, but I think again, and I'm going to sound very repetitive, but I think the key to that is support, right? Like some of those aspects that I just talked about can also be challenges, never feeling like you can like take off your teacher hat, because no matter where you go in the community, you're seeing these kids wearing the multiple hats. As you're trying to serve different kids' needs can become taxing. And so, but when you have that support key, I really think that those powerful opportunities can become really meaningful impact areas as well.
Diana, how do policy decisions impact exactly what we're talking about that are made at either the state or national level that land differently for rural school districts versus urban school districts?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, rural needs are different than urban needs. And to make it even more complicated, rural needs are not one size fits all, right? Across North Dakota, we've got a lot of different rural communities that are different sizes, have different needs. And so, you know, I think one problem comes that either, you know, on one end, we're not thinking about rural schools at all. And on the other hand, we're thinking about rural schools in this kind of one size fits all kind of like, you know, mythic way that's maybe not actually real. But I think, you know, in some tangible ways, there are infrastructure issues of a resource disparity across rural and urban schools. There's different funding issues about, you know, the types of dollars that rural schools are getting based on student attendance and per capita attendance, but also there's higher overhead costs in rural schools. I think consolidation and the tradition of consolidation has created additional strains on rural schools. And so all of those are factors that are affecting rural educators.
Franny, a moment ago, you talked about the disparity in teacher pay for rural schools versus urban schools. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, golly, you know, I don't have the stats right in front of me, Craig, but I do think that the research shows that rural teachers typically earn less than urban areas, right? Whether it's a funding issue at the policy level or how we're dispersing our money. But it does, it makes it harder. And, you know, I think a lot of times there's this misconception that living in small rural areas, that the cost of living is cheaper. But I would argue that as somebody who lives in it, that is not true. Right? The housing market can be just as expensive. Going to the local grocery store, you're going to pay a lot more money for groceries. And so there's things that you have to think about too, like Diana said, like when you're trying to weigh these things as a new teacher, like, gosh, where am I going to go? And how am I going to pay back these student loan bills and utilities and all these other things and still have a manageable life? It's a conversation that needs to have. And I think that sometimes you do the really easy thing in teacher retention and say it's only a compensation area. And I think it's deeper than that too. So I think that's why it's important to be thought partners and really get out there and ask the tough questions.
Do we know whether rural teachers stay in the vocation longer than urban teachers do?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot of research in that specific question, but from what I've seen broadly is I think this turnover is pretty widely felt. I think that, you know, urban schools face a load of challenges too that enhance turnover. But I think that, yeah, I think that teachers generally are grappling with these issues. And so I don't think this is a rural problem.
Sure.
Yeah.
if each of you were to go to Bismarck and talk to legislators, what misconceptions about teaching would you really put to the forefront as they shape their policy decisions? Diana, you first.
Okay. That it's easy, that anyone can do it, that people should do it purely because they love kids, right? Should do it because they love kids. It'd be a problem to not, but you should also want to teach because you have a, you know, real excitement and passion for instruction, for the development of children, for that kind of inquiry. Yeah, those would be my three.
Franny?
I love Diana's. I'd love to add on that too, that I think one misconception is that when you're looking at policies, that it's just about teaching and delivering content, right? Like people forget just, I think, so much of the relational content of education. And I think sometimes when you're looking at policies, it assumes it's only about covering the curriculum or meeting the standards. And I think we often ignore the supports that teachers need to actually help kids learn. There's just so much more to actually just delivering content.
I want to jump ahead in what I had planned to talk about to make sure that we cover it, but I want to understand the impact of private and charter schools on public education. And I want to understand whether the expansion of private or charter schools is impacting public school teachers here in the state, especially in rural or resource limited areas. Diana, do you want to take that first?
Hop in first. I mean, I think it's important to have a diversity of educational opportunities, right? Families have different needs, students have different needs, and those needs are best determined by, you know, their families and then by the professional educators that they consult. So I don't think that private schools or a family's choice to, you know, homeschool is in and of itself a detriment to public education. Where I think it does become a dangerous relationship, though, is at the policy level when we link these together with funding, right? And so when we say that we have this limited pie of funding for education, and that when a family chooses to do something else, that's resources, limited resources that are getting pulled away from public education. That gets really dangerous because public education, public schools have a calling that is distinct and critical, and that they cannot turn away a student, right? A public education is going to serve all the children of the community, no matter their needs. That's not something that a private school has to do. A private school can turn away any student that they don't think is a fit for their school. And so as we lose those resources to support other educational opportunities, that's where the problem comes. So the existence of multiple educational opportunities is not a problem. I think tying them together, their funding, is where we have some issues to resolve.
Mm-hmm. Franny, what do you think?
I agree with Diana. I think it all goes back to that funding. And I think in rural schools, right, it also goes back to a little bit of enrollment. When we're talking about pulling kids out of our school, and like Diana said, that's a family choice. But when we have schools that have very few enrollment, it makes me a little nervous because what's happening to these rural schools? And are we going to lose the heartbeat of a community? You know, we have schools in North Dakota that maybe only have 8 kids in a single grade level. And when we're pulling kids out of there, it does make me feel a little nervous. I think also, Craig, speaking specifically to my role as an interventionist, I don't think my role as an interventionist really has a place in private education. And so I'm very, 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 and like you said earlier, like my slogan is like success for every student every day. And so I think that with my role and my lens that I wear specifically, like I'm very, very passionate about the students where school is maybe a little bit hard. And maybe there are some learning needs and some skill gaps. And that doesn't necessarily happen in a private education because like Diana said, you can turn students away. So I think that there's a lot of very important things about public education. But echoing Diana, I think when we're talking about funding and cutting funding of our public schools to give to private education, I think that's where the concern really lies. And that's where I get really nervous.
So is funding then, Diana, you first here, the only policy, I guess, emphasis that states should balance school choice with protecting public education? Or are there other policies that also need to be considered when we're talking about how states should balance school choice?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, I think I always want to defer to educators. So I think local control is incredibly important. And so in terms of deciding what is taught, how it's taught, all of that, I think that those are best made as close to the classroom as possible by teachers, by individual schools. And so I think that to have policymakers who are not professional educators removed from many of those decisions is probably wise. I think
that can't happen though necessarily at the state legislature, can it?
Right, absolutely. And so I think right now, you know, I think if we're limiting some of our focus to funding, I think that would be wise, right? How can we well resource public schools so that they can be successful. I think, and I think a lot of that means bringing educators and teachers into those policy discussions to ask them what they need, right? Those are some key missing voices from those conversations.
Franny, do you have any ideas on, I mean, one of your roles as being Teacher of the Year is you get to advocate now for public education. Yeah. And so what's your message to policymakers when they try to find that balance that we've talked about?
Well, Craig, I've told you I'd love for them to come in and spend a day with me in my classroom. I think that would just be so delightful to have them roll up their sleeves. They can come into my classroom. I'll give them some tasks and we can all work together. I think that, you know, I would love that. And so that's number one. Number two, I think, like you said, like using this role as an advocacy tool and trying to amplify voices and begin dialogues and be thought partners with these people. I think that, you know, when you talk about these policymakers, they're doing what they can with the information they have. I don't think anybody is trying to make decisions that's hurting public schools. And I think that's important to recognize. And yet, I think that sometimes it's on us as educators to engage in those conversations, which isn't always a fun thing. So I'm really looking forward to this year and being able to engage in those conversations and have some dialogue about funding and about other policy things to just say like, hey, how can we help support educators a little bit more? And here are some lived experiences. Like, here's what it actually looks like in the classroom because of some of these different things.
It's so unfortunate in my mind, and I think Franny and I have touched upon this in earlier discussions, that teaching today has become politicized. It melds down into this discussion sometimes about private schools and public schools. What does that do to trust and professional identity to teachers, Diana?
Yeah, I think that the politicization of teaching is a really important thing to talk about and to try and prevent, right? Teaching is not a political act. I suppose it could be, but inherently it's not, right? Franny has been talking about that. I think it does so, and I think there's two opposite things that happen. So it sows distrust and discord about what's happening in the classrooms, right? About curriculum, about books kids are reading. And that kind of distrust is never the basis of a good relationship. But on the other side, it also creates anxiety and stress for teachers who are unsure of what they can say and what they can teach. And not only does that contribute to reasons why teachers are exiting the profession, but it inhibits their ability to well serve kids, right? I mean, when you take a topic like history, right, to be able to engage in debate and to be able to think through critically different perspectives, that's not only essential to understanding a topic, but it's essential to being a citizen in the United States. And when we strip teachers of the confidence to do that, the ripple effects of that are going to go far beyond how a student did on a learning assessment, right? We'll be grappling with that for generations.
Mm-hmm. Franny, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Diana. You know, me and a couple colleagues had just written a paper led by Dr. Logan Rutten about this topic, about difficult topics in, you know, the classroom and how as educators do we grapple with those? You know, do we lean into them? Do we lean away? Do we defer to a parent? Like, what do you do? And as a teacher, I can say it's very exhausting to have to always try and think in your brain, like, gosh, if I answer this topic, if I answer this question, is someone going to think I'm trying to politicize something? And so I think that Diana hit it right on the head there. And I think it continues to be something that's weighed heavily. And I think too, when you think about COVID, Craig, like I remember going on Facebook, right? And you'd go online and all these people were talking about how, oh gosh, like educators deserve the world. And I'm at home trying to teach my kid and I don't know how teachers do this. And you've kind of seen the shift back down to, like, you know, Diana does a lot of research on like blaming the teachers. And we're kind of back to that again, right? We're like, we're trying to indoctrinate children, which, you know, spoiler alert, we're not. But I think it makes it hard to do our job. And I think that layer of support that we've talked so much about too, kind of makes you feel like you aren't supported by your broader community, which is something that weighs very heavily on educators.
So let's talk about paths forward or signs of hope as we kind of wind down our discussion here. What policies or programs give each of you the most hope for improving recruitment and retention here in the state?
There are a lot of exciting things going on. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there are reasons for concern, but there's also a lot of reason for optimism. And I think that that optimism is happening at the local level. So some examples, I think pipelines into the profession are incredibly important. Getting prospective teachers excited about teaching from the time that they're in high school, maybe even earlier. But I also think multiple pathways to the profession through professional education. So thinking about career switchers and ways that people can make their way in. I think there are some incentives. I know that districts across North Dakota are already thinking about housing, and they're also thinking about loan forgiveness. Those are incredibly powerful tools that are not cheap, but are very effective when it comes to retention and recruitment. Partnerships are another example. University district partnerships are a really powerful way to not only bring that sort of recruitment, but also to retention, because that's a sustaining relationship that will continue. It's also a way to help, you know, rural schools. So I think, you know, UND is taking a lot of efforts in this area where we're deeply committed to our local district, Grand Forks, but also not just stopping there, right? And how can we prepare teachers that are going across? And then I think finally, attention that this issue of teacher shortages isn't just about hiring more teachers, but also more staff in the school building that can support. And I guess I just want to say one last thing on this as I think about it. As we've been talking a lot about the importance of support for teachers, but I want to really emphasize that what we're not calling for here is control of teachers, right? Because the key factor in teacher retention is autonomy, is teachers feeling like they have the space to make decisions, they have the space to be creative, and that's where support comes in, right? But it's not the kind of support that can lead to this narrowing and constriction of what teachers do, but giving them the time and the resources where they can be creative, where they can meet individual students' needs.
That's so important in many vocations, teaching for sure. Franny, what are your thoughts?
Gosh, well, I got goosebumps there at the end, Diana. I just absolutely love being thought partners. And I think that was so powerful to share. I think the other one thing that wasn't mentioned was the mentorship program that's happening right now in North Dakota at the state level. And just making sure that we're really providing our, you know, induction teachers with some really strong mentorships, so that they do feel those levels of support. And they do have somebody who's continually checking in on them and answering those questions. And just somebody that's being a friend in the school buildings, I think, is really important as well.
You mentioned stats earlier in our discussion, Franny, and I'm a geek when it comes to numbers. And a lot of my college education was spent in stats classes. Do you see the trend line coming up or trending down relative to positive change in North Dakota's education system, specifically to this topic of teacher retention, teacher training, and teacher recruitment?
You know, Craig, I'm really hopeful that we're trending upwards. I really think we are. You know, I think there's some really big momentum happening too. I think of right now, like specifically the North Dakotans for Public School and the work that they're doing to dispel misinformation and celebrate teachers and strengthen our public school by really advocating for us is just really great as well. And so I'm very hopeful that we're moving up.
Diana?
Oh, absolutely. Hope and optimism is always the right choice here. And I'll tell you why specifically though. You know, educators are always working hard, right? They're always invested. But the thing that is most heartening to me is the work that some of our graduate students are doing every day. Students like Franny, students like our other doctoral and graduate students, and the research that they're doing, they're asking really important questions. And they're not asking questions that we've been asking again and again, right? They're asking about why rural teachers stay and leave. They're giving voice to rural teachers in a way that we have not seen before in research. I have another student who's doing some really exciting work on university district partnerships and teacher preparation. And I think together that work is really going to help turn the page.
Mm-hmm. Franny, if communities could take one concrete step to better support teachers right now, what should it be?
I would say that it would be to treat us like professionals, give us respect, the resources that we need to do our jobs, and to support us when we do a really, you know, just give us the support that we need to do our jobs well.
Diana, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a version of Franny's, and it's basically how I ended my book, which is listen to teachers, right? You know, ask teachers, because it's going to be a different answer and a different, you know, circumstance community to community.
Well, Franny, I want to tell our listeners what's coming down the pike. On the second Mondays of each month, we're going to talk about education-related things. And here are the topics that we kind of worked together to bring our listeners. Student mental health and behavioral support, educational equity for rural, tribal, and underserved communities, workforce aligned career and technical education, evidence-based early literacy and strong foundations, public education stability amid growth of private options, sustained high quality professional development, and also the importance of teacher-student relationships. Mm-hmm. We're going to dive deep into this world of education, Franny, that you're working and Diana so hard to improve. I want to thank my guests, Franny Tunseth and Dr. Diana Pollowitz, for their insights today. North Dakota's teacher shortage is complex, but as we've heard, real support, respect, and manageable workloads can make a meaningful difference in keeping great educators in our classrooms. Everyone would agree that that's what we want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. And I just want to thank you, Craig, so much for giving us this platform, and Diana for being thought partners. And gosh, this was so fun.
Thank you both for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra presents On Broadway, featuring vocalist Emily Walters, performing unforgettable Broadway favorites from the big screen, including Phantom of the Opera, The Wizard of Oz, Wicked, and more. The concert premieres January 16th and 17th at the Belmehus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. Tickets are available through the Bismarck Event Center, at the door, or online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, helping families reach their dreams throughout the Bismarck-Mandan area. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 12th. On this day in 1907, staff of the State Historical Society dined out at a new restaurant in town, the International, owned and operated by Wong Wu, a local restaurateur. The International specialized in Chinese food for hungry residents and visitors in downtown Bismarck. Located in the Quinlan Building, next to Richholz, 406 Main Street, to be precise, the International advertised itself as a first-class restaurant, offering short-order service. Open night and day, Wong Wu served meals at all hours, something the State Historical Society staff must have appreciated, as receipt books show they dined at the International for supper. In addition to familiar Chinese dishes such as chop suey, Wong Wu introduced new ingredients from China and other Asian countries to entice local customers. In March of 1908, he advertised canned bamboo tips, ready to eat and experience. The bamboo tips were expensive, costing him 75 cents a can because of the difficulty of securing them from the tops of bamboo trees at just the right time. Wong Wu did not stay at the International for long. By December of 1908, it was reported that he had sold his interest in the restaurant to his night cook, Lee Chuck, and was headed to Mandan. In October of 1909, Wu was advertising a restaurant in Minot that he ran with Lee Sung, called the England Restaurant, though it still served Chinese food. Plain chop suey and all kinds of noodles were his specialties, with chop suey priced at 35 cents. Running a restaurant is never easy, and they can close just as quickly as they open, leaving hungry customers when a favorite lunch spot disappears. The staff of the State Historical Society would have had to find a new place to eat after Wong Wu left his restaurant for lunches and the occasional work dinner. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Ashley Thronson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
The FM Symphony presents Masterworks 3, Symphonic Giants, January 17th and 18th. The program includes Dvorak's Slavonic Dances with the Area Youth Symphony, and pianist Tyler Wattridge performing St. Sane's Piano Concerto No. 2. Information at fmsymphony.org.
New year.
I want to ask about the United States Senate for 2026. This is a map where...
New beginnings.
So, Scott, what's your sense of how this is going to play out?
New stories.
Wow, wasn't expecting that. What do they want out of this lawsuit?
Wherever 2026 takes us, Morning Edition from NPR News will be there. Stay informed with us every weekday morning.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Mayor Howard Klug from Williston. He's led the community through boom times and challenging transitions as the city adapts to rapid growth, infrastructure demands, and evolving community needs. We'll talk about his leadership and the future of Williston tomorrow right here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.